Welcome to Native America Calling from Studio 49 in Albuquerque. I'm Monica Brain. We're getting a new look at the Red Planet thanks to the new Mars Perseverance rover. Today we'll talk with a Navajo engineer who worked on the project. Also, a Cherokee Nation Supreme Court ruling made a major change to the tribal constitution on tribal identity by removing the phrase "by blood." It's a culmination of a long fight by Cherokee freedmen. And a new investigative series takes a look at how oil pipelines intersect with the interests of Native nations. It's a regular news roundup. We'll be right back.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The South Dakota State Senate supports a resolution to open an inquiry on the soldiers who were awarded the Medal of Honor for their participation in the genocide of around 300 Native Americans. Richard Tubbles reports.
The Wounded Knee Massacre occurred in 1890 after a group of mostly Lakota elders, women, and children led by Chief Bigfoot were seeking refuge on the Pine Ridge Reservation when they were deterred by the U.S. Army's 7th Cavalry near Wounded Knee Creek. They were stripped of their weapons, and after a shot rang out, they were eventually gunned down. 20 U.S. soldiers were awarded the Medal of Honor. Native Americans have opposed this recognition, including Remy Bald Eagle, a U.S. Army combat veteran who served in the Middle East.
For me personally, as a soldier, as a combat veteran, it gives a little bit more legitimacy to my service. It is difficult for any Native American to love this country because of what we've been through. But we love this land, so we stand up for it, and we go to war for it.
Bald Eagle is the spokesperson and enrolled member of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe. He says this resolution is the first of many to honor those Native Americans who were massacred that fateful day and to restore the honor of the nation's highest honor of valor.
The United States, you know, the United States prides itself on freedom and being united and liberty and honesty and integrity, and awarding medals of honor for the massacre of women and children and babies is none of that. And I think it's a statement to not just the people of the United States, but the rest of the world, that we can step back and say we have wronged, and we're going to make steps to right that wrong because we have integrity.
This resolution, according to Bald Eagle, may take decades of persistence for it to ultimately happen, but it's a good first step in creating a path to healing and understanding each other's differences. In Rapid City, I'm Richard Tubbles.
A petition drive to keep a Native American-themed mascot for Roseburg High School in Oregon is underway. KLCC's Brian Bull reports.
In recent years, most Oregon public schools ended their Indian mascots unless a local tribe agreed to co-sponsor it, which is what the Cow Creek Band of Umpqua Indians in Roseburg High indicated in 2017. With a 3-year revisitation term up, some Roseburg alumni and families are working to keep the Indians. In an email to KLCC, organizer Sony Provencal says she'll submit a petition ahead of the local school board's meeting on Wednesday, saying the community identifies as Indians and supporters admire the Cow Creek Band. But there have also been recent calls to end the Indians, with critics arguing neither the deal nor the mascot represents all Native people. RHS alum Amanda Mendoza, who identifies as Muscogee Creek, Choctaw, and Cherokee, says non-Indians claiming the mascot honors Native people doesn't sit well with her and others. A feedback form for Roseburg Public Schools has seen hundreds of responses.
For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
The Indian Health Service has surpassed its goal of administering 400,000 COVID-19 vaccines by the end of the month. IHS Chief Medical Officer Rear Admiral Michael Tote credits reaching the goal with partnerships with IHS, tribal, and urban clinics across the country. The IHS is currently distributing Pfizer and Moderna. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Yeah. National Native News is produced by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the American Indian College Fund, providing scholarships to Native students of every age for over 30 years. Applications for the upcoming school year accepted through May 31st at collegefund.org.
Support by the Sanosky Chambers Law Firm, championing tribal sovereignty and defending Native American rights since 1976, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Monica Brain. NASA is searching for ancient life in the rocks and soil on Mars. After landing on the red planet, the Mars Perseverance rover is giving us a new glimpse of the landscape. Today we're going to talk to a Navajo engineer, Aaron Yazzie, about his contribution to the project. And I'll give you a hint, it involves drilling. Also, the Cherokee Supreme Court ruled the phrase, by blood, must be removed from the Constitution. It has to do with the long-standing conflict over the Cherokee freedmen roles. Today, we'll talk with reporter Allison Herrera about what this ruling means for the citizens of the Cherokee Nation. But first, pipeline projects are a long-standing source of conflict for tribes. The fights over pipelines usually boil down to efforts to protect water and land that are important to tribes. Pipeline proponents point to revenue and jobs for oil-producing tribes. Indian Country Today national correspondent Mary Annette Pember is taking a look at this in a new series. She's Red Cliff Ojibwe. Welcome back to Native America Calling, Mary Annette.
Hi, it's good to be back, Monica.
So tell us about this series.
Yes, well, it's, you know, we decided to do a series because it's a very complicated issue. Enbridge Line 3 that is going from, it actually is an existing pipeline that they are framing it as a replacement project from Alberta, Canada, going down through Minnesota over to what they call their manifold in Superior, Wisconsin. It's about almost 400 miles of pipeline, but it's a part of a much larger project called Mainline. The Mainline project, which is, you know, really the largest pipeline in North America that Enbridge runs. So most immediately, they are currently constructing Line 3, and there's quite a lot of controversy over it. So that's kind of why we're focusing on that most immediately.
Yeah, one of your first pieces, you interviewed a former pipeline worker who's Native. Tell us about that.
Yes, his name is Jason Goward, and he's a citizen of the Fond du Lac Band of Ojibwe, not too far outside of Duluth in Minnesota. And he had worked at the pipeline. It's, as I said, a little bit complex. The old pipeline, which I think was initially installed like in the 50s, they had easements through a couple of reservations, through the Leech Lake Reservation, which is farther west, and the Fond du Lac Reservation. And what they were wanting to do is they want to replace it with a larger gauge pipeline so that they can carry tar sands from Alberta, Canada. So the Fond du Lac kind of got backed into a corner. The Minnesota Public Utilities Commission approved Enbridge's route. So either the tribe could agree to let the route continue through their reservation, or it could be rerouted. And they, through which is a lot of this land is really ceded treaty land, so they utilize that land to hunt and gather. So the alternative route, I think, by their reckoning, would have been endangered more fragile wetlands. So they opted to allow the line to go through its existing route in exchange for a lot of money, I think, and which is they have not disclosed, and an agreement not to publicly oppose the pipeline. Now, some people, you know, as you can imagine, some citizens do oppose it, and some people are for it. Now, the pipeline jobs actually pay a lot of money. A lot of tribal members have been working on the pipeline or for their contractors. So it's a really difficult thing, I think, to navigate. Some people feel very strongly that the pipeline, if it were to leak, it presents significant, you know, dangers to these fragile waterways, and, you know, spills could ruin wild rice and other ecosystems in the region. And there's a real strong spiritual and cultural tie, you know, as you know, to subsistence living and hunting and gathering. Mm-hmm. So people have those feelings. But then again, one wants to make money and one wants to feed one's children in a good way. And so, I think my impression is many people feel, well, it's inevitable that this pipeline is going to go through. And we might as well, get a piece of this money, you know, while we can. So we're seeing families actually divided over this, people not talking to each other. It's been really hard, I think, for those folks.
And the gentleman who was the pipeline worker, he actually had a change of heart.
Yes, he did. Sorry, I kind of veered off a little bit on that.
No,
he was working, you know, for a contractor and working this big equipment, you know, and he saw some people who were protesting, who were like friends and relatives against the pipeline, and he, you know, began to think about it, and he said he sort of had an epiphany. It just felt really wrong to him. You know, he's a person who is in, he's in recovery. And for him, you know, the Ojibwe traditional ways have been really sustaining for him and really helped him. And so he felt that doing this work didn't align with what he's about now and with what he wants to pass on to his kids. So he quit, and he's actually joined the people who are opposing the pipeline. So His mother's mad at him. His grandma's mad at him. I mean, he needs to pay child support. He needs to pay his mortgage, and just like everybody else, car insurance and various things. And so he's in a difficult place.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, I think he feels like it was the right thing for him to do personally, you know, sort of spiritually, and he's missing out on this money. So it's been a hard thing, I think, for him.
Yeah, it sounds like a big sacrifice that he made. So I want to throw this out there for our listeners. If you want to weigh in on Enbridge Pipeline in particular, you can call us and talk to us about it for now until we move on to our next topic. But get your calls in now, 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. So would you say like line three is splitting up tribes, splitting up, you know, you said that the families were getting split up and things like that. What is the atmosphere in general? Is it like the tribe is evenly split or, you know, and you can speak to this in terms of Fond du Lac or other tribes, because I know that other tribes in Minnesota have weighed in on Enbridge as well.
Yes. Now, the Leech Lake tribe has opted to have Enbridge just remove the pipeline altogether from the reservation. So they'll be, you know, whatever the new route is going around them. It's difficult to really gauge how many people are for or again, you know, as my mother would say. A lot of people are, for instance, now in Fond du Lac, people have told me that they're afraid to speak out. Because, you know, it could potentially jeopardize their per capita payments or any services that they receive. And as a sovereign nation, of course, you know, the tribe, you know, they have authority over, you know, to whom they want to extend these services. So it's rather difficult to say. People, according to the people who did speak to me, you know, for Jason and the young woman who is actually, she created a camp near, quite close to one of the Enbridge work sites. She actually she crowdfunded like $30,000 to buy this little piece of land and created Camp Migazee, which is a water protector camp. And a lot of people are there. Some people from outside the reservation, some people from you know, local citizens are supporting it, and they do actions. Sometimes they protest, they go out and, you know, carry signs, and then sometimes they have done some things like locking themselves to construction equipment. And there was an incident here quite recently during one of these actions. I think it was a peaceful action, but somebody threw some packages, drove by and threw packages at the construction site, at the workers, and into one of the pipes that were there, like exposed on the construction site. And the decision was made to call the police about that, and the police, you know, determined that there was some sort of noise coming from the packages. And so they opted to call in the bomb squad, and they evacuated a portion of the reservation. And it turned out there was they weren't bombs, but, you know, there's a lot of tension.
Holy. Do you know what was in the packages? Were they just clocks or?
They didn't. I asked, and I did ask the Carlton County Sheriff, and she says it's an open investigation, so she wouldn't comment.
How do people feel? I mean, you know, I want to talk a little bit more with you about the tensions that folks are feeling on the reservation about this pipeline fight. But I also want to invite you, our listeners, to call in and share your thoughts now. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Marionette, we're just about to go to a break, but about, you know, how many articles are you planning for this series?
As many as are needed, I guess. I have something coming out, a short piece coming out Monday, and then I'm also pursuing some other stuff. So there was recently, I think I mentioned to you, there was a sex trafficking sting in the area, and the seven men who were arrested, two of them for sure, were employees of a pipeline contractor.
Yeah.
I'm going to write about that.
Yeah, I want to hear more about that after the break, because there have some folks have drawn connections between increases in sex trafficking and oil work in the oil fields. And it's, you know, something that is of great concern to Native America. If you want to get in on this conversation, phone lines are open. We're live today. I'm in the studio. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. After the break, we're going to talk some more with Marionette Pember. She's a national correspondent for Indian Country Today. Health and emergency experts say the current pandemic offers lessons for future disasters. We'll hear from some of them on how they are preparing for the next pandemic. We'll also check in with the chief medical advisor to the president, Dr. Anthony Fauci. That's on the next Native America Calling.
Ilingnun nakuaqutulutin suli ummatin nakuluni alladlun nakuaqutikkun qukhula yuminyaq si Indian healthcare provider 1-800-318-2596 nakakarisakhangwa si healthcare.gov unakavluni Center for Medicare and Medicaid Service.
You're tuned in to Native America Calling. I'm Monica Brain, senior producer, and it is our monthly news roundup. Before the break, we're talking with Marionette Pember. She's a national correspondent for Indian Country Today and a citizen of the Red Cliff Ojibwe tribe. And so, Marionette, you were just starting to talk a little bit about the connection between sex trafficking and work in the oil fields. And I wanted to give you a chance to talk more about that and what you're hearing from folks about the concerns that they have sort of drawing these connections.
Well, as I mentioned to you, they did conduct a sting. It was a combination of organizations, and tribal, state, and I think federal. Actually, Minnesota is probably farther ahead of a lot of states in the way that they, you know, address sex trafficking. They're aware of it, and many states are not so much. But there is a lot of people have drawn, I think, pretty clear correlations between extractive industries like the oil patch in Bakken and sex trafficking, any kind of an industry in which larger groups of single men, work alone, work and live alone, and particularly in a remote area, they find that there's an increase in sex trafficking. So there was people that I think they were super aware of it, and the sting that they conducted last week did net seven men, as I mentioned, two of whom we know for sure worked for pipeline contractors. So, earlier Enbridge had put out statements, there's no correlation between, what we're doing and sex trafficking. We don't have man camps. In the truest sense, people are kind of spread out, living in hotels or campgrounds or what have you. So they were really trying to downplay that. However, we're finding, it looks like there is a correlation in this instance.
Let's take a call. We've got Don in Spooner, Wisconsin, tuned in on WOJB. Don, we're talking about pipelines. What do you think?
Well, one thing that hasn't been brought up very much is that this pipeline was actually proposed for Canada, and the Canadian people rejected it, so they came down to America where the politicians are more purchasable. So they're just buying their way through. Another thing that hasn't been brought up is, well, actually, I listened to the last show, and one of the people from Enbridge was talking about the Kalamazoo accident, or incident, I would call it, and said, yeah, he went canoeing down there. The one thing he left out was that the only reason they found out about this is one of their employees turned them in for covering up the incident. Mm. And if that hadn't happened, what would be the situation there? So the other thing that I had on this is that, they have insurance and so forth for the risk, but when they're done with the pipeline, they'll all go home to their rich little places wherever they live, and the risk is on us. We're the ones that assume the risk. If the pipeline breaks somewhere, it's not going to affect their lives. It's going to affect our lives, and we don't get enough return on investment on our end for the risk that we're taking, and that's all I got.
Thanks, Don. Nice to hear from you in Spooner, Wisconsin, tuned in on WOJB. And Marionette, is Don's opinions, have you heard similar things from folks in Fond du Lac and other areas along the pipeline?
Yes, I sure have, and I think he brings up a very important issue that a lot of people bring up, is that it's not sustainable, these kinds of jobs, when, any of these extractive jobs. And also the other thing that I thought was really interesting, many people were bringing up, people who oppose the pipeline, that, that whole area, and of course other areas of our country, have really been, their economy has always been focused on some sort of extraction, First, would have been animals, trapping, and then, lumber, timber, and mining. So, it's very much embedded in, I think, people's mindsets there. And people are, willing to participate in that. But, it's very short term, it's a very boom and bust. And that's actually what a lot of the people, particularly the people I was speaking to in Fond du Lac who oppose the pipeline, say, yeah, this is going to be done and we're going to be left here. And, we just hopefully, we'll repair our relationships with our families and our leadership. But it's a lot of mess is left, after these kinds of projects.
Mm. Yeah, your latest piece, Pipeline Dreams, Enbridge Escalates Local Tension, talks all about efforts to do peaceful protests and things like that, and being blocked and not being able for folks to exercise their First Amendment rights. Can you speak a little more about that piece?
Yeah, thank you. Some states have passed these sort of protest laws, and they for anybody protesting projects like pipelines or oil extraction. They're classifying it as, you know, you're jeopardizing, you know, essential infrastructure. Now, Minnesota has resisted that, although there have been some efforts to do so. But Enbridge, you know, like a lot of these companies, does spread a lot of money around. Now, keep in mind, they've been trying to get this this project has been a very long time in coming. I mean, I think it began in like 2014, and it was a long permitting process, and a lot of Native people and a lot of environmentalists and citizens opposed it all along the way, all throughout the process. So during that, though, Enbridge has donated a great deal to charity and various like community events and organizations. They've also created, as the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission said, well, you know, okay, you guys are going to come here and put this pipeline in. What if we get a lot of protests? And what if we incur a lot of costs, you know, dealing with, you know, they were, this is coming off of, you know, what happened in Standing Rock in North Dakota. So the Public Utilities Commission demanded that they create, Enbridge create kind of a fund, a policing fund that they would pay into, and that then local, you know, local jurisdictions could be reimbursed for their policing costs. Well, there's a lot of jurisdictions that this pipeline goes through. So some of these small, you know, sheriff's departments have been, they've been, you know, I think, been making a fair amount of money, you know, not that they, not to say that I'm in any, I didn't find any evidence that what they were doing, that they were getting reimbursed for anything illegally. But, I mean, I do think that it has been helping, you know, their infrastructure building. And that kind of, I started seeing that there's quite a bit of that along the way, that Enbridge has really built a lot of, you know, a lot of support by contributing to, you know, various organizations and communities. So people are, they're reluctant to really speak out. And this is non-Indians as well. This particular small community that I focused on, where they denied some water protectors access to a public park to have an event, and they actually went to the county commissioner. It's in Aiken County, and to the little city of Palisades, the little park, Berglund Park. It's along the Mississippi River, and they wanted to, the water protectors just wanted to organize kind of an educational event, a family-friendly event. And I guess typically in February, they often have these winter festivals in that part of the country, even though it's like scary cold. So, and because of COVID, they kind of had, you know, cut back on that. But, you know, they came up with the idea, well, let's just have it entirely outside, and then we'll social distance. And couldn't we just use the park? And it's often been a pretty informal process to gain access to this park. But, you know, the young woman organizing it, Shanae Matson, who actually was born and raised in Palisade, was shocked to get these emails saying, well, you know, we're really concerned. And given these concerns, we're going to deny you access to this park, which, you know, essentially is really denying them free speech and their constitutional rights. So, you know, actually, it was an organization in D.C., the Center for Protest Rights, sent a letter to the county commissioner saying, you know, you can't do this. You know, I mean, if you have, you know, unless you spell out a really kind of, you know, a very clear permitting process for using, you know, these parks. But given that they're public spaces, I mean, you know, this really, you can't really deny this. So it was really surprising that the emails that, you know, she shared with me between the sheriff and between the county commissioner and herself, basically threatening her with arrest. You know, we haven't arrested you yet, but we might.
Wow. Wow.
And we have video of you, you know, walking into basically trespassing. So, you know, I was able to learn that that sheriff's, Aiken County Sheriff's Department, they recently received a donation from Enbridge for $5,000. And they went to the county commissioners as part of, like, you know, open records laws. They had to sort of file that, oh, this is on the agenda. Basically, he was the sheriff was going to say, get permission to go ahead and accept this contribution. So they have really built a lot of goodwill. And, you know, the Center for Protest basically, you know, alleged that, you know, you're acting as like a, you know, a private security organization for this private company, and has called them out on it. So they're not talking to anybody now, the county and the sheriff.
What about?
I did write about it.
Yeah.
because I think it was interesting for people to know.
What about Enbridge, Marionette? Are you going to reach out to them and chat with them for this series?
Oh, yes. I have been reaching out to them fairly often. And they do release the statements, you know, which often don't really, you know, address very exactly my questions. But yes, I do include that in all of my coverage. You know, that's part of my job is to speak, you know, to everybody involved. Mm-hmm. So they have not been super forthcoming, but they do, what I do have to credit them, they do respond. You know, it's usually with a statement. It doesn't necessarily exactly, you know, address my question. But they have been, they're far more sophisticated, I think, in addressing any kind of community criticism of their projects. You know, they've learned, Enbridge, who is part owner, by the way, in the Dakota Access Pipeline, they learned some really good lessons from Standing Rock. And they have integrated that in their corporate culture very effectively. So they're good at kind of, you know, at the chilling certain criticisms.
Yeah. Well, are you going to cover other pipelines for this series? I know, I mean, Keystone is still, you know, it's in the back of people's minds. They're still worried that it might, you know, rise up from the dead. Are you going to take a look at any other pipeline issues?
Well, you know, who knows what the future is. I mean, you know, this is still pretty interesting and there's a lot going on and I'm focusing on it. It's you know, it's a lot to understand and to research to do the correct job. So I'm trying to do that. So I don't know, maybe. Depends on what happens.
Well, I'm going to put links to Marionette's articles on Enbridge Line 3 and her part of her pipeline series on our website at nativeamericacalling.com. Marionette, always great to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me, Monica.
And if you're just joining us, it's our monthly news roundup. If you want to give us a call, weigh in on what we're talking about. Phone number is 1-800-996-2848. Let's take a quick call before we go to our next guest. We've got Gordon in Red Lake, Minnesota, tuned in on KOJB. Hey there, Gordon.
Thanks for having me on. I just wanted to tell the story about what happened to me with my gallery in Park Rapids, Minnesota, and my property I own there. Everything kind of went to heck when the city of Park Rapids flooded my downstairs area with 200,000 gallons or 20,000 gallons of raw sewage.
Oh.
So that's how this whole thing started. And after I'm still in litigation with the city and the state for trying to get my I end up losing my property, and I lost my gallery, my building, and everything. And when I come back to town about a month later, Enbridge has my building, and Enbridge has my property.
Oh, wow.
So, and there was nothing but pipes on my property. The house was still there and everything, but the building was totally, it was a historical building, downtown Park Rapids, and I'd sunk all of this money into it. And when they flooded me, it just ruined everything. My business went down. I ended up losing my house and everything. I'm okay now. I got out of that. That was almost 10 years ago when that happened.
Wow.
So we're still in litigation, but I just wanted to, you know, it's kind of peculiar how they ended up with everything they want as they come down the line. It's kind of crazy. I don't know if they're in with the cities or I'm sure they're doing politicking, but I just wanted to throw that out there. I'm a victim of Enbridge, so I just wanted to put that out there. And
yeah,
thanks for letting me air my
your sewage
yeah,
story.
Yeah.
All right, Gordon. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. All right, we're going to move on to another topic. We're going to talk about a recent Cherokee Supreme Court ruling. On the line, we have Allison Herrera. She's an Indigenous Affairs reporter at KOSU, and she is Halone Salinen. Welcome back to Native America Calling. Allison.
Thanks for having me on, Monica.
All right. So we're going to go to a break in about 2 minutes. Do you think you can summarize this recent Cherokee Supreme Court decision in 2 minutes?
Yes. Okay. So it was a ruling on Monday that struck the term by blood from the Cherokee Nation's constitution and laws. And it pretty much ends a decades-long debate over citizenship status in the largest tribe in the country. And this was in response to a Cherokee Freedman citizen by the name of Marilyn Bann was going to run for tribal council, and somebody had challenged her using the by blood language. So, so they struck this from the Constitution, and it really pretty much just says full stop. There is only one kind of Cherokee citizen. So, but it's a little bit more complicated than that. Maybe we can talk a little bit about that after the break.
Yeah, that would be great. We've had Marilyn on the show before to talk about the Cherokee Freedman issue. And I know that the current administration in the Cherokee Nation supports they made the decision to stop fighting the lawsuits over the Cherokee Freedmen. And there was this really incredible moment that we had on our show where the principal chief welcomed Marilyn Van back into the tribe. It was pretty incredible to see that. But I knew that there is definitely still a lot of citizens who have issues with the freedmen and issues with, having them as citizens on the Cherokee Nation. And so we're going to talk more about that after the break. We've got Allison Herrera with us. She's the Indigenous Affairs reporter at KOSU. And I want to give you some space as well if you want to weigh in on this issue. Give us a call. The phone lines are open. It's 1-800-996-2848. Also, at the end of the hour, we're going to talk about the Mars rover. The Mars Perseverance rover, and if you want to weigh in on that or just share some excitement about it, you can call in for that as well, 1-800-996-2848. So after the break, we're going to talk more about this Cherokee Supreme Court decision that removed the phrase by blood from their constitution and what this means for Cherokee freedmen, particularly Marilyn Van, if she's planning on running for Cherokee Nation president, Cherokee Nation principal chief. 1-800-996-2848. There's a few other ways you can reach out to us. You can send us an email to comments@nativeamericacalling.com. You can tweet us at 1-800-99-NATIVE.
Support by the American Indian College Fund, who have been providing scholarships and other support to Native students of every age for over 30 years. Scholarship applications for the upcoming school year are being accepted through May 31st at collegefund.org. That's collegefund.org or by phone at 800-766-FUND. Application deadline is May 31st.
You're tuned in to Native America Calling. I'm Monica Brain. It's our monthly news roundup. And Allison, before the break, we were talking about this Cherokee Supreme Court decision. Is this decision final? Or is there any possibility of it being reversed or anything like that?
I think it's unlikely that it will be challenged. I mean, I'm sure that, there could be an amendment introduced. In 2007, citizens voted on a constitutional amendment to put the by blood language into the Constitution, and that's what was challenged. And you mentioned the Marilyn Van, the Nash Cherokee Nation versus Nash decision that came down in 2017, and which effectively granted freedmen citizenship into the tribe. So Marilyn Van, is running for a seat on tribal council, and so the challenge was that she wasn't eligible. And I think, what this means is that, yes, she can run, and that, at some point she could run for principal chief. But you mentioned that not everybody is happy about this decision, and that is certainly true. And there are some Cherokee citizens that are very upset by this decision, not because they don't support the freedmen, but because they feel that striking this language from the constitutional was not legal. It should have been put to a vote by the people. And I think I would compare it to saying that what if, a judge or a lawmaker in the United States decided, okay, we're going to strike some language from the United States Constitution, and they feel like this wasn't right. That and some people feel like, well, the 2017 decision already eliminated the by blood language. So why do you have to go in and take something from the Constitution? That's not how we do it. That's not the process. And so people are very upset about that. And again, I'm just going to reiterate, it's not because they don't support Freedmen. It's because they don't like the process with which it was done. And but I will add that there is some anti-Black racism that exists in the tribe. I've spoken to a few people about it. And so that does exist.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you think that the Cherokee Freedmen issue is settled with this ruling?
I mean, I think on its face, yes. But, you know, I think that there's still, you know, some, it seems from people that I've talked to that there's still some, you know, issues to be settled with, like, you know, accepting them, you know, I don't want to say culturally, that's the wrong word, but just, I've said this a lot in other pieces that I've written about, you know, laws that were passed to change something that people feel is discriminatory. You can pass a law to say that it's not right to discriminate, it's not right to do this, it's not right to do that. But you can't pass a law you can't change people's feelings with a law.
Right.
And I think that's the issue.
Yeah. And I feel like we've learned that more last year than many, many other years on record. Let me squeeze in a call right now. We've got Marge in Warm Springs, Oregon, tuned in on KWSO. Hey there, Marge.
Hello.
Hi.
I've been listening a little bit, and I think about this Freedmen issue, which comes up every year practically. But I do believe, and I'm grateful that they accepted her to run for office. And I believe the acceptance is a Native thing, that when everybody was being terrorized by the explorers, I call them explorers, and they noticed that not only were the Indians being terrorized, but the men of Black were being terrorized also. And in those days, our Native people reached out to help. And we need to carry our elders' hearts with us when we accept that. Because my band was placed on this reservation from the during the Modoc Wars. And so this used to be their country, but then they got, because of the Modoc Wars, everything got taken away from them. But then they went to jail, and then they were released back to this reservation. And we are seen as a third band with this reservation that I'm with now. And we run for council, and we participate in everything because, you know, it in the days when we were all being terrorized and our populations and families were being killed, we helped each other.
Mm.
And I just hope that the Cherokee, and I know they can do that too. And it sounds like some of them are. So keep the Native blood going and the Native heart.
Mm. Marge, thanks so much for giving us a call from Warm Springs. Nice to hear from you. Allison, what else have you been working on?
Well, earlier this month, I published a story, an investigative story, about some allegations that were made against the Quapaw Nation's former chief. He'd been former chairman. He'd been in office for 20 years and was defeated last summer by, you know, relative newcomer. There were some allegations about him illegally donating money and illegally enriching himself. So there was an audit that was performed, and so I reported on that, and it got some attention. And I'm doing a follow up story about the Quapaw Nation's process to redo their constitution so that they can further, you know, protect themselves against you know, this kind of you know, alleged corruption. And so, you know, it's interesting to me, you know, they've had the same constitution since 1956. You know, that at that time, you know, they didn't have casinos, they didn't have all of these other businesses that, you know, made money for the tribe. And I think they're at a point, they say to me, the reporting that I've done they feel like they're at a really critical point right now where they can, remake the Constitution to allow for more transparency and openness in government, which is something that the citizens have said that they've wanted for quite some time now.
I love stories about that, and it's like watching us, our own democracies in action, you know? And of course, as a member of the media, I'm all about ultimate transparency. Allison, go ahead.
I was just going to say that, my beat at KOSU, Graham Lee Brewer is my editor, and we discussed how our reporting is obviously, we have a large audience. We need to, inform Oklahomans and tribal citizens about what's going on in the tribes, everything from vaccinations to, important court rulings. But also we want to serve the citizens of those tribes and be accountable to them in our reporting. And I think we've sort of shifted away. We've shifted into that. And I think that that's a really important, I just wanted to point that out.
Yeah, Allison, thanks so much. It's always great to talk with you. Allison Herrera is an Indigenous Affairs reporter at KOSU. And finally, today we are going to Mars. Actually, we're headed to California to talk to Aaron Yazzie. He's a mechanical engineer at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab, and he is Diné. Welcome back to Native America Calling, Aaron.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Well, I'm excited to talk to you today. So tell us about the Mars Perseverance mission.
Yeah, the Perseverance mission is the latest rover that NASA has sent to Mars, and successfully sent to Mars because it just landed there on February 18th. It was a very exciting day for all of us that got to work on it, because the entire landing sequence to land a giant car-sized robot on Mars is very difficult. But this mission that we're sending there is essentially going to drive around on Mars and look for interesting rock targets that we think are hiding information about Mars's distant historic past, might hold the keys to possibly ancient life forms existing on Mars. So we hope to drill into rocks and extract these rock core samples that we can study so that we can bring them back to Earth and study them here on Earth.
And so you worked on one specific part of the rover. I think it was the drill bits or something like that.
That's right. Yeah, I was the lead engineer for all of the rover's drill bits. So the rover is able to switch out from a set number of bits. We sent nine total bits with it. And there's three different types. There's the type that can drill into a rock and extract a rock core, so a little cylindrical piece of rock that's about the size of a piece of chalk. And that's our most valuable type of sample. That's the one that will be able to get way inside of a rock where it's been protected for billions of years. And we think that that's where we'll most likely find ancient life forms. We have two more types of bits. One of them is we call it a regolith bit. Regolith is basically loose rocky material like sand or soil. So we can get a sample of that. And we also have an abrading bit, which is a little short, wider bit that can sort of remove the very top layer of a rock and get us beneath that, like that outer layer that might be weathered and affected by a harsh atmosphere. And so we want to get below that so that science instruments can take a really close look at a nice, fresh piece of rock.
I heard that before the rover even gets there, there's this something called 7 minutes of terror. What is that?
Yeah, so the 7 minutes of terror is something that we call the entry, descent, and landing sequence. That's when we're trying to land this rover on Mars. And the reason why it's terrifying is because the entire sequence only takes 7 minutes automatically from the time that it hits the top of Mars's atmosphere and goes through multiple stages to deploy a parachute and to look down and see where it's about to land and to divert itself. It comes down on this essentially a jetpack to lower it down very carefully hover just above the surface of Mars. And then it lowers the rover down on a set of cables that we call the sky crane, just to the point where the rover's wheels touch the ground. And then that whole stage detaches itself from the rover and flies away. And then what you have is the full rover by itself, safe on the ground. That whole sequence takes 7 minutes, and we have nothing to do. We can't joystick it. We can't control it real time because Mars is so far away from Earth, it actually takes about 11 minutes for a signal to fly from Mars to Earth. So by the time this entire sequence has happened, we are in the dark. We don't know if it is successful or not successful here on Earth until 11 minutes later.
If you guys can land a rover on Mars, then why can't I have my own personal jetpack and fly around on Earth?
Oh, I wish we could all have our own jetpack.
But no, seriously, though, you are collecting samples and bringing them back here. And there is, you know, what is the expectation that you will find evidence of life? At, you know, 50%? What are you thinking?
I'm thinking that I'm along with the project scientists who are very enthusiastic about the possibility that there's life there. I think there's a very high percentage. And the reason why we think that is because all of the past rovers that we've sent there have built upon knowledge of the previous one. So the first one was really just to prove that we can drive something on the surface. The next one, which were the Mars exploration rovers, were there to look for water, and they found evidence of water. Uh-huh. The next one was the Curiosity rover that was really just, it was trying to figure out if Mars even had an environment at any point in its history that was capable of even hosting life. And it said, yes, there's evidence of water, there's evidence of the right chemical makeup in these rocks that I'm studying, that all of the components are here to, and so that leap points to life could have existed here, just like how Earth developed to have life. Why not Mars, since they're very closely related types of planets? And so this is the last mission that will really confirm for us. We send it to a place that used to be an ancient lake bed. So this, if there was life there, this is the right place to look for it.
Do you watch Star Trek?
I actually don't watch Star Trek, so I'm the worst nerd in the world.
Well, there's this idea of the Prime Directive, which is that, you know, you don't interfere with other life on planets. And I'm just curious your thoughts on this, you know, particularly being native, about the idea of taking things away from Mars, you know, when there was life there, if there the possibility of it.
Right. Yeah, that is interesting. As a native person, that is a unique thought process that I have to think through and deal with. I definitely don't want to feel like the colonizer. I don't want to feel like I'm invading the inhabitants of Mars. At this point, we don't exactly think that the type of life that we're going to find is basically microbial, like some kind of
so you won't be finding like
a fungus,
skeletons or things like that.
Right. We won't find things with toes or anything like that. We're thinking just things you would find at the bottom of a lake or a stream or something.
And what do you think that will tell us about the history of that planet?
I think it'll tell us a few things. One, we've always believed that Mars and Earth are very similar and that they developed in the same way, almost kind of the same time scale from their very earliest development to now. And Earth looks like Earth is what it is today. It's this amazingly beautiful planet with water and life and animals. And then Mars, at one point was a wet and warmer planet. So it could have looked more like Earth, but for some reason it developed over billions of years in a different way, and it looks the way it does now. So I think we're going to learn a lot about terrestrial planets in general, which means that we're going to learn a lot about our own planet as well. Like how does a rocky planet form in the solar system, and how does life come to inhabit that? So if we find life on Mars, it'll give us a huge bit of knowledge about ourselves, but also like the possibilities open up and are endless about what else is out there. What if we go to another solar system where there's another rocky planet that has similar attributes?
Well, I am just nerding out about this. This is so exciting. Aaron, we'd love to have you back again to talk more about the work that you're doing on Mars. Will you come back?
Of course. I love to talk about it.
All right. Well, thank you so much to our guests today, Marionette Pember, Allison Herrera, and Aaron Yazzie. We're back on Monday with a show discussing the next pandemic. Our executive producer is Art Hughes. Our host is Tara Gatewood. Our associate producer is Andy Murphy. Marino Spencer is the engineer. Nola Daves-Moses is the distribution director. And Bob Peterson is the network manager for Native Voice One. Clifton Chadwick is our resource development specialist. Antonia Gonzalez is the anchor and producer for National Native News. Charles Sather is our chief of operations. And the president and CEO of Quantic Broadcast Corporation is Jacqueline Salee. I'm senior producer Monica Brain. Have a good weekend.
Native America Calling is supported by Oregon State University eCampus. The strength that comes from your tribal community can make all the difference in reaching your goals. Oregon State eCampus is committed to providing another source of strength with a supportive educational community that respects your culture. Earn your degree online, but not on your own. Visit ecampus.oregonstate.edu/Native America Calling.
Ah, chest spukni, quag tet isha lia spentch. Ne gulent luas beus chuspioti, mhets quest et zia luan chmenchten. Hol necht semi, tkulkul tausent luas skelly such mariem yach sachem. Tkuiment healthcare.gov, uqua tkulkul tausent, 1-800-318-2596. Hiets mamit in Centers for Medicare u Medicaid Services.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Quantic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davis. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.